Okay. This is John Tortorici. I am in Jerusalem, and it is November 28th, 2014. I'm here to interview Professor Stephen Oschein, Professor Emeritus of History at the Hebrew University, and George Mossy Doctorate. So we'll get started. So Steve, where were you born and when?
Oh boy.
Going back to day one.
If we are talking about when I was born, we have to go into dinosauric history. I was born in Johannesburg in South Africa in 1942, which seems so long away, but that's it. That's the answer to your question. Don't publicize it.
So, when did your family arrive in South Africa?
Yeah, well, the first thing to be said is that all this is very obscure and vague. Mm-hmm. My parents, who were German Jewish refugees, didn't speak much about this, in fact, almost not at all, and I, being stupid, never pushed them for an answer. So what I will tell you is approximation. I think that my father came sometime in 1936. My mother came a few months, maybe a year earlier. Her parents, my mother's parents, left Germany, I think, in 1934, and left my mother, as far as I know, to finish high school with a non-Jewish family in Nazi Germany. Now, this is not proved. It's something that kind of wafted to us, and I think it's probably true. Then my mother joined them when she finished school, and I think came early in 1935, maybe. My father had still not arrived. He had gone from Germany to England, was not granted permanent status there, and then took a boat to what he thought was jungle-laden South Africa. He had been in touch with my mother's parents to rent an apartment, because my father came virtually penniless, and German Jews organized a kind of self-help community. And so my father was going to live in my grandparents' home in a single room with a curtain dividing him from the other guy. At any rate, the apocryphal story is that when he arrived in 1936, my mother, who was 17 years younger than my father, that means she was 17 and my father was 34. The apocryphal story is they arrived. They went to the station to collect my father, and my father got off the train, looked at my mother and said, "Doris, let's get married." And they got married very quickly after. Now, how true any of these stories are, I don't know, but that's the mythical background to my family.
So, your father came here penniless.
He didn't come here. He would never have dreamed of coming
here.
To
South Africa, penniless. And yet, you grew up in a very well-off family. How did this happen?
I grew up in opulence, you could say. Mm-hmm. And half of my life has been a revolt against that opulence. How does that? That's one of those typical immigration stories, especially of middle class Jews. My father started off selling eggs from door to door. Met this fellow from Zurich, Mr. Wheel. They decided they're going to go into the dress business, and I think this was in about 1943. Remember, South Africa's untouched by war. Mm-hmm. It was a time of booming industrialization and economic expansion. They came at the right time and built it up into a massive dress, stockings, and dare I say, brassiere factory. So by the time I appeared, when I was born, I think we were still very modestly well off. But over the years, we lived exceedingly well. And part of the reason was of my joining the socialist youth movements had to do with some kind of discomfort with it. Now I deeply regret that stupid attitude. It would be wonderful to have money, but that's the way it was.
So, did you live in a Jewish enclave? Did you live where? When did you decide to get involved with Zionism?
Well, first of all, you are not that you are not Jewish. That's not relevant. But you are American.
Right.
So you will have almost no idea about the structure of South African white society. First of all, South African society anyway was organized racially and ethnically. Black, white, blacks, coloreds, blacks, Indians, whites. Even amongst the whites, identity was ethnically or religiously oriented. So you had English-speaking non-Jews, Afrikaners, and Jews. And nary shall the twain meet. I don't think I ever saw a non-Jew in my house, apart from our black servants, but they weren't really people, you see, boy and girl. And so your whole social life, your whole sense of identity was enclosed within your particular ethnic community. And so I don't recall one intermarriage in our community. Now, that's changed drastically. But at that stage, that's how things were organized. So when the time for my revolution came, it was through the Zionist youth movement, which defined itself antithetically, but was as ethnically exclusive and bound as everything else was. So there wasn't even a question of departure. The only people who really departed from this, and I was too scared to do this, were the people who joined the underground of the anti-apartheid movement, where blacks, whites, Christians, Jews, all mixed.
But was that a little later, Steve? I mean, that was in after apartheid came in, what, in the late 40s?
Yeah, 50s? Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah. No, I'm talking about, I was born in 1942, mm-hmm. so the mm-hmm. time I came to consciousness was in 1959, mm-hmm. 60. Mm-hmm. And during mm-hmm. the 60s, we did know people who joined the underground and then who kind of disaffected from the community. Mm-hmm. Ours was an affected, disaffected attitude. So mm-hmm. it was a kind of, I would call it pseudo-revolution, because we really stayed within the bounds.
So this racialism, which really permeated South African society, I mean, you could say it was British or Dutch, but it was an imposition on the system that was already there, but just permeated all aspects of life. Were you at all in relation with the black community besides, I assume as servants would be the...
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. first of all, you were brought up by black people. And the black people, it's very interesting, they were domestic servants. And the word applies to them, they were domesticated. Mm-hmm. So they were part of the family, but of course they knew and you knew what their real status was. And there was a great deal of affection there, and I think mutual kind of liking. But clearly, the division was at their quarters. They were called servants' quarters. First of all, they couldn't really go home because of the pass laws. Once every 3-4 months, they could go home. Their rooms, which were adjacent to our house, just in the backyard, were terrible. Cold water, primitive as hell, And there wasn't a sense of outrage. In the same place, there are vast differences. So I used to enact, and from the early age I saw this is absolutely wrong, but from an early, but I was also a good Jewish bourgeois son. And my relation to my parents was an extremely good one. So my ideological revolt sometimes we used to discuss, but never threatening the family fabric. But my revolution was going into the kitchen and singing African songs, sometimes Kozi Sikalele, which became the freedom song of the ANC and then the national hymn. That became my outlet. But all this is pseudo. This is Mel Brooks, you know. Main source of transportation is fear. That characterizes me. So I cannot claim that in any way I was involved with serious anti-apartheid activity, but it was clear from the beginning that something was dreadfully wrong, including the total self-indulgence of the white community. You would never wash your own dish. You would never do your own bed. You would take for granted being served. So,
But you never spoke to your parents about this contradiction that they came from persecution, racialist persecution, to a place where racialism was embedded so distinctly. This was not something that they talked about.
First of all, let me preface the. I will get directly to the answer, but I must preface it by saying, as I told you, there was much too little history, much too little I knew about my parents. The fact that they were German Jewish refugees came up maybe very occasionally and in oblique terms. They never referred to themselves as survivors. They never referred to themselves even as refugees. There was none of that. So when you say they themselves were products of racial oppression, first of all, that was never really represented to me. That's not their self-representation. But equally, I've actually written about this. It seems to me that given the fact that they were refugees and that, for instance, England wouldn't take them, their main response was not indignation about racism, but gratitude that South Africa took them in and gave them a chance to succeed fantastically. So and of course they're good bourgeois people and you have to be loyal to those who are granting you these rights. So that was not really an issue. And yet, from the time I was vaguely conscious, I internalized the Holocaust. I don't know why or where it came from, but I was intensely aware of that. And that does have to do with my feeling about apartheid and racism, and it has to do acutely with the way in which I believe we are conducting ourselves here. So if my parents didn't have that consciousness, I have it, and I'm no refugee or survivor. I don't know if that answers you. But
yes. So where did you learn about the Holocaust? From your parents? Or was it in the Jewish community? We'll get to your schooling, but it sounds like your schooling was more...
No, schooling had nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. It's a good question. It takes place at different levels. The first level is the subliminal level, which is that if you're a Jew in South Africa, you mustn't have America in mind. It's very different. If you're a Jew in South Africa, you are a conspicuous and very, very self-conscious minority. You know you are Jewish, and so you don't want to stick out too much. So I always had this consciousness of difference. And I suppose it's through My parents' accent and occasionally understanding they came from Germany, a movie here, a movie there, that I began to understand what was going on. But I'm talking here at a very, very young age. It wasn't a theoretical matter. It was something you kind of imbibed. And that's why I'm also still a Mel Brooks Jew. Fear as a mode of transportation. So yes, I can't tell you, it was never systematic or theoretical. It kind of entered into me, and I cannot tell you why, because my parents did not dwell on it at all. They sometimes spoke about Germany with contempt and say, oh, those bloody Germans or something, but that's it.
But, so there wasn't a sense that this in some ways reflected on what was happening in South Africa.
For whom?
For you as a child. I mean, did you make the connection of this this imposed system of racial categorization in South Africa as you started
from the Holocaust?
When you started to learn about it, and did you see that it had, because it seems like what you did was move more towards the Zionist Youth Organization, mm-hmm, as your response to this.
I didn't connect the Holocaust then, mm-hmm, to apartheid. I did realize that apartheid was shockingly oppressive, mm-hmm, but the strength of my Jewishness was probably too strong to make any immediate kind of connection. If you ask me now, that's a different thing. We're talking about when I was, I don't know, 9 years and more. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different thing. Mm-hmm. So I never did make that connection at that stage. No.
So you went to a rather strict boys' school, from what you were telling me the other night. So tell me about this school. It was.
I may break out into a rash.
It sounds like an absolutely dreadful
South school. African education at that stage. There were only boys' schools or girls' schools. There's no mixing. Was deeply authoritarian. Was disciplinarian. Never taught me a thing. I mean, and they must have taught me how to read and write, but never taught me anything. And basically, if the teacher would ask a question and I would put up my hand and say, "Sir, I think," the teacher would say, "Don't think." Now, that's not exactly your ideal institution. And I don't think I'm going to go over this again. You've heard it too often. It doesn't have to be. The fact that I was given cuts and caned and a great deal of anti-Semitism, clear anti-Semitism. Yes, absolutely. But I think you've heard these stories. I don't want to tell you more. You don't need it for this, do you?
All right. Well, you know.
Do you need those stories?
They're wonderful stories in showing what it was like to experience that kind of education. But I understand that, you know, maybe one story.
All right. Well, first of all, Mr. Yule, who was my chemistry teacher. And I can tell you now that in mathematics and in chemistry and physics, I was not a star pupil, as you will understand. But for some reason, every time there was a non-chemistry discussion, Mr. Yule would turn to me. And in his enlightened way, Mr. Yule said, "Asheim," I said, "Yes, sir. Do you know why World War II was fought?" And I said, "No, sir." He said, "I'll tell you, Asheim. World War II was fought because of you people." So I said, "Sir," and you couldn't argue with these guys, "Sir, I can't really tell you why that's not correct, but I do not think that's correct. and he sent me to the headmaster for caning. So you get some idea of what kind of things went on there.
Hmm. It explains to me, anyway, why you ended up in Israel. Because, you know, I think that kind of experience makes a Jewish homeland all that more attractive.
Yes, I agree. I'm glad you're taking the Zionist side here. But another very important reason for getting here, and it's also difficult for an American to understand, that the experience, and George would know this, I mean, the experience of the youth movement. Mm-hmm. All my closest friends still are here, and we are still all together.
Zionist, Habanim.
Camaraderie, yes. And ecstasy. It was a kind of mad ecstasy, mm-hmm. of singing, of laughing, of sex, of meaning, uh-huh. ideas, ideology. I have intellectually outgrown it, but I haven't emotionally mm-hmm. outgrown it.
Uh-huh. It's very attractive.
And now I'm very, very critical of it, you know, and in many ways it was so ecstatically enclosed that one had pure contempt for anything else outside. So if anything brought me here, what you say is correct, is no question, but the steam, mm-hmm. the lubricant was that, and I think that still applies. Mm-hmm. And George understood that.
Mm-hmm. He did.
I think he really got yeah. that. Yeah. And when he showed me how similar to the German folkish movement this was, that opened my eyes.
This group that you met in the Zionist youth organization, Habanim.
I prefer you to call it Habanim, even now the word Zionist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said that this was one of the most meaningful things in your life.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And that you're still friendly, dear friends with this group. And it's really an extraordinary group, the ones that I've met here in Israel and in America. But I'm struck by how close you all are and how you relate still on such a intimate way, you know, that you're funny with each other, you're supportive. It's really, I can see how that would
by the way, I don't know if we want this recorded, but yeah. You know, Zev Mankiewicz is in hospice. He's dying.
I'm sorry.
I don't know if you knew him at all.
Yes. He and his wife gave me, when I first came to Israel, gave me a tour. And
wait a minute, what year was this?
Well, it wasn't the first time I came to Israel, actually. It would have been right after George died, which would have been 99.
Ah, okay, yeah. So that's not Jean, that's Bella.
Bella, okay. Yes. Okay. She's okay. The one that I
know. Okay. Yeah, no, that's all true, but I'm not sure what your question is.
Well, I think it was more to enhance what you said about the power of this attachment, this association, and how it's carried through your entire life.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that isn't so common for men in particular to have lifelong group of friends like that. You all, it sounds like most of you stayed here in Israel, even though you...
Are in the States or in Canada or in Australia, mm-hmm. but there is a group here that mm-hmm. did remain, and many, they've done well, including one you met who's now vice head of the Fed in America, Stan Fisher, who is way and above everyone else, there's no question.
But still very
But it's not the accomplishment. You have, you know, it's one of those things you have to be in, so it would be silly. It works almost totally, and that's why I was so attracted, amongst other things, to George on humor. Mm-hmm. On absolute, you know, kind of mad humor. And that's how we do it. I think that's a big thing. And apart from comedy, I'm sure you have common experiences with friends that you had, associations, all those other things. Mm-hmm. But it's also being foreigners here, which keeps us together. Mm-hmm. English is all our main it's our lingua franca. So there are all kinds of things. But I mean, the reason I took to George immediately, I didn't know his academic work. It was his hilarity that got me.
Great person.
And then it developed into other things. But that was the first thing. Mm-hmm. Shall I tell you the first story when we met at Zev Mankiewicz's house? I think we've talked about this. This was in 68, when the student revolutions were really going on. And we were aware of it. And we said, Professor Mosser, how on earth do you deal with the student revolution? There's violence, there's mad things going on. And he said, oh no, Steve, no student revolution begins before 2 in the afternoon. I teach at 10. So the moment he said that to me, I said, right, this has got to be a good guy.
Well, he didn't take it all that seriously, unlike some of his colleagues. That's very true, yes.
Well, he encouraged part of it and
he did,
limited
yes.
other parts, right?
Yeah. He did. Yeah. He was taken with it. I think he saw the potential and he thought it was great that young people were mobilized, you know, in shaping their own future.
Right.
I mean, he obviously was not too pleased by the direction it went all the time. But
Very so true. That's when we met in 68. It's a long time ago. Wow.
Yeah.
Anyway, so where are we?
Well, we have your, you know, we've already discussed from the time that you arrived in Israel on.
Oh, we have.
Essentially. That tape I have still. So. So we're at the point when you were engaged with the Habanim. And tell me, how did your... You say that there were no teachers, really, that engaged you. So how did your great interest and passion for history emerge? Did that come... I mean, I know you were at the London School of Economics, and how did you end up going into history?
I did my B.A. Mm-hmm. in... sociology and political science. I did my MA in London in political sociology. So my first two degrees had nothing to do with history. So then you have to look for different routes. Again, you have to come to the youth movement. Why? Because it is there that you had passionate intellectual debates, discussions, and where your mind was liberated. Where you were encouraged to think. True, it went along ideological lines. It was a movement, an ideology, but it had intellectual content. I gave, for instance, I was 17, and I was giving kind of seminars on Isaiah Berlin. And I remember the first time I read a serious book is when I was 14. I went to the Zionist Federation and took out Bein's biography of Herzl. This is 14. And at school, it would never have been so. So it was two tracks. One was school, which had absolutely nothing to do with reality. And the other was Habonim, which is where it wasn't history. It was thinking. It was ideas. It was ideals. And until I got to university... And at university, it was liberation. You were opened up to things, and Johannesburg was a reasonable university, but the reading we had, you could read what you want, you could explore. So it was at university that, and the youth movement that I started, and the only reason I became interested in history for me until then was, what were the four reasons for the Industrial Revolution? Why did the French Revolution occur? Number one, number two, and if you get number two as number one, you failed the exam. Dry facts, uninteresting.
It's the way it's still taught too much.
Terrible. It didn't interest me. Mm-hmm. And yes, here the role of George for history. Was it? I tell you, I was going to do my PhD in sociology on dehumanization, but it was all about abstract, impersonal structures. And then comes George, and I said, about culture. And I'm attracted to things cultural. George's critique about German Jews that, you know, they confuse culture with politics, I'm guilty of that to this day. But that's what set me alight. And so had it not been for George, I don't know what I would have done. I wouldn't. I mean, he did. He molded my career. I went to Madison, Siberia, for George. And yes, that was where my real passion and interest lies until this day. But I didn't know that until I met George.
So he had this ability to bring out in people what was already there, but they didn't realize it. You know, that he sparked something.
He definitely sparked, but I mean...
Yeah.
But the first thing he sparked, I'm telling you, was not that. It was his mode. It was his being, much more than his actual work. Mm-hmm. When he walked in, then after that evening about the revolutions, I went to his class on anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And the first class he walks in, he says, looks at the class, says, "Oh, you're all Aryans, all Aryans." So of course you go for that. I mean, then immediately. So it's that got me.
Uh-huh.
It was the human with the erudite thing that coupled for me. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got into history.
Well, we're talking about a recent event we had in Madison where so many of Mossy's undergraduate students from the 60s came back. And this was another case of him just having such an impact on undergraduates and, you know, who didn't know him that well. And yet they still, 40, 50 years later, are trying to figure out
what it was. And what did they say it was?
Well, you know, it was we're just beginning to explore this, but my understanding is that he had this ability to pull students into a thoughtful way of looking at the world. You know, he just pulled them out of what they had done, a critical way of looking at the world. It was like it woke them up. And in a way, they're going back and trying to figure out the trajectories of their life, where the great influences were, and they're coming back to Mossy, you know.
But then the question is, how does he pull them out? And I think part of it, it's only a part of it, his capacity to personalize.
Yes.
That is, right. He will relate to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't go on, but one of the things, when I was in Israel, as I told you in the second tape, which worked, I taught in these various institutions, the leadership thing and the students thing, and when he met my mother, whom he'd never met, he said, "Hello, Mrs. Asheim, do you know your son is the Goebbels of Israel?"
What a great line.
And so my mother was shocked out of her mind. But you see what I mean?
Yes.
That's the... Suddenly,
spark.
It's got nothing. I mean, I really was nothing like the Goebbels of Israel.
Well, he always,
but he gets to
that,
you know.
Yes.
So he gets. Yeah. That's what he. It's a kind of shock, but a humanizing shock, and done with humor too. I'm sure that a lot of people remember the Mossa stories more than they do the intellectual framework of which he said. I'm pretty sure that's how it works.
But also, I think he took his students seriously. He gave them the compliment of taking them seriously and challenging them. And they remember that, too. So they do remember that. And also, I think there's an ethical and moral aspect to it, that he was able to spark a kind of moral understanding of history and your place in the world and how you have to engage in the world in a moral, ethical, historical way.
Yeah,
I think all of that really, you know, at a time when this whole thing of relevance or whatever, but when people were looking for that, as they always are.
Yeah.
But I think he had this ability because he saw history as very much, you know, a life's calling, as a way of understanding the world. I mean, for him, this was, you know, the way of understanding the world, obviously. So,
yeah. No question.
Yeah. So I think they understood that. So, well, I don't know that we need to talk much more about your youth, unless you have something more to say. But I want to talk to you about...
Well, first of all, I admire your ability to ask others questions about themselves.
Yeah.
Not, you know, you go to the Hebrew University and you'll find that virtually every professor is willing to talk endlessly about themselves.
That's not only the Hebrew University,
right.
By the way.
Right.
But, you know, I think your teaching style has some relation, more than some relation to George's style. You have...
It's dual. It's double. The first thing is that I was raised in the youth movement, and then you were taught how to keep the interest of kids. It wasn't an obligatory framework, so you had to keep the kids' attention. So the first one it is there. You know, if you know how to give one of your talks and to motivate the kids, that was all part of the youth movement. And then you add George, right? So. Although, yes, it's modeled partly on George, but I'll never have the guts or the authority that George did. And I'll give you one example. He was teaching at the Hebrew University in the early years. Is it still working? And he was giving a class, I probably told this in the other interview, on Weimar. And there you had old Weimarians in the class. And one Weimarian stood up and said, "Wait a minute, I was there, it wasn't like that at all." And George would say, "You are in the valley, I'm in the mountain." Now, for instance, I couldn't say something like that. That does take a certain authority. I couldn't do that. So in that sense, George was unique in that sort of thing. So I couldn't do that sort of thing. And there was another thing I wanted to say on this.
Well, it seems like that your attempt to engage...
When have you seen me teach?
Well, in Madison, although you wouldn't let me come to your course too often, but I've heard you lecture. And, you know, you have this ability to reach out to the audience and also to interject humor and, you know, to... pace your teaching, but also to pull them in.
But never had anything like that impact. Just can't compare.
Well, that brings
the way it is.
Yeah, that brings up your career here at the Hebrew University. So when did you get hired here? You was it in the early 80s that you
82.
Came back? 82.
Okay. I came back.
Yeah.
And why did I come back? Because George spoke to Arieli, who spoke to the dean, and there I was. No interview, no lecture, nothing. There I was.
That's the way it was in those days.
That's the way it was. It's not possible today, even with the highest of the high. It's just not possible.
So...
Yeah. 82.
Yeah. Some of these people, and we've already discussed... Yeah. The trajectory of your career here on the other tape, but I was wondering, I mean, from your vantage point teaching history and modern Jewish history, German Jewish history, I mean, from the Hebrew University, you've really witnessed an incredible parade of the major intellectuals in this field through Jerusalem. You knew so many of them. You still know so many of them. I mean, you were in a key position.
Wait, just hang on. Before you go on, just let me say, well, it only really just applies to one But there's something about the camaraderie of Georgia's students which is not that different from the camaraderie of the youth movement.
It's fascinating. Well, not only, by the way, you and Andy, there are many others, Seymour, there's, you know, David Sabian.
But I'm not in their circle. Yes. I mean, I'm talking about the nature of the friendship which was formed as a result. Mm-hmm. That may be true for Cy and David.
Very much so, yes, very much so. But did you have that sense here at the Hebrew University that you were, you know, a part of a community that you were in that really at the center of a very important effort to understand German Jewish history, some of the people that you engaged with, that you knew?
Well, first of all, you have to divide into two. I don't think there was, for me, a serious intellectual community working together on that question. All of us were doing it, we were reasonably friendly, but there wasn't a kind of close-knit intellectual community working on these things, although we all did in our own different ways. But the second thing is, there's no doubt that being in Jerusalem, what I wrote or what they wrote has had particular resonance. It may not have the same resonance today. That centrality may be deeply questioned or even over now. That's another question.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean with the decreasing legitimacy and the perception by so many people of the problems here, I'm not so sure that we are seen as an authoritative source anymore. Mm. At least nothing like it used to be. Mm. Also, I think the last major world-famous historians that came out of here would be Talmon in general history and Yaakov Katz in Jewish history. Whereas you could say, in America, the most famous Jewish historian worked until a few years ago, and that was Yerushalmi. So, and today I can't think of any historian, Jewish or general, and you know there's the silly cut between Jewish and general history, who has a similar status to the greats. Now the question is, are there any great historians either in Europe or America? That's another question. But I don't think we are as resonant and as relevant as we were 20 years ago. And I don't think that's romanticizing. But I must say something else here, which is ideological. That the longer I've been here, my reading of German history, and this I think George would understand, is very much dictated by the situation here.
I find that to be the case for many Israelis.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you know, there's a problem there, but maybe also something good. I don't know if George... did George see my book in which I wrote about Klemperer? Some people were amazed. You know, I basically attacked Scholem and defended Klemperer, who's an assimilationist. So, you know, where does that come from? That comes from my situation here.
You know, George had a relation, Eva Noack Mosse, and her situation was very similar to that of Klemperer. I mean, she married a Gentile, and she ended up at Theresienstadt.
How was she a relation? She was...
She was the daughter of one of George's grandfather's brothers, I believe daughter or granddaughter. And anyways, I'm having translated this memoir, which, well, you could read it in German. I can send it to you in German. But it's amazing the similarities between her experiences and Klemperer. And also the way she writes, it's nothing about her, in a sense. It's not about making you feel empathy for her or feeling sorry for herself or look what they did. It's just very factual, high level of rational analysis of what happened to her, because she, and I think she felt that she was writing for, as a warning, as a caution.
Where did you get the memoir? Did George have it, or you got it subsequently?
I got it at the Leo Beck Institute.
Oh.
They told me about it.
Oh.
And actually, she corresponded with George. Mm. And I think there's something like 10 letters, so I'm going to have those translated too. But no, you didn't write about Klemperer during George's lifetime, but that book had just come out, I believe, and your book on Klemperer.
It came out in 2001.
Okay, that book came out in 2001?
I think, yeah.
Okay, because I know I recall that he knew about the book. Maybe there was two volumes.
Yeah. And maybe Charles Friedlander, I asked Charles what he thinks. He said it's not complete. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say a word more. I said, well, give me a criticism.
No.
Not complete.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, George and Shaul, mm-hmm. although Shaul is younger than George, born in 36,
right.
Mm-hmm. Can't take a step that a lot of people who are younger can take because of their respect, and correctly so, for the achievement of creating the state at a time when it was crucial.
Yes.
But we're not prepared to say, wait a minute, there's some very, very basic things here which you have to face. Walter Lacour is another.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think George understood this contradiction. He had this, you know, romantic idea of nationalism with the human face, that in Israel is where it was most profoundly manifested.
Correct.
But quickly, you know, but he, hope springs eternal. But I think for him it was a very personal reason, and that is, you know, fundamentally he was wounded by his own history in that sense of insecurity deeply, and I think that he really did feel great attachment to Israel, and also to the, in particular to the people, you know, to that group that he knew. For George, Israel was a group of intellectuals essentially and their families, and he didn't have much interaction with the rest of Israeli society from what I can tell. I mean, anyways, he didn't learn Hebrew
that's the story of that I repeat everywhere, right? You know, I mean, Adonai.
Yeah. Right.
Right, the waiter, Adonai. I get wonderful service.
I think, by the way,
when you say his insecurity, I argued with Friedlander, and maybe I'm wrong, and said George didn't act as a survivor, and Shaul says, no, he was deeply wounded and therefore insecure as a survivor. I said, no, I may be wrong. But I think another part of my attraction to him was that his insecurity accounts for his humanity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that's
he knew that.
You know, okay, well, fine. I mean, that's what...
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, when you think of what a powerful personality George was, and he always said that, you know, exile made him, because you could imagine him as a very, you know, arrogant, nasty person. I mean, he could have been if he had had a very secure, you know, grown up as the son of a very wealthy man, and you know, I think that part of his personality might have been more manifested. But when you see what happened to him and his sister, they both became these great humanitarians, and, you know, this universalist vision, they lived that their whole lives. So You know, but I think that was because of the experiences mm-hmm. that he had. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he understood that about himself, I think. I think he was deeply wounded. I think that it did make him very insecure, but he had a lot of courage, I would say. He kind of was able to overcome that and present himself in a certain way that was very different from that. You know, I think
his bodily movements mm-hmm. gave him away.
That's right. Yes.
But that also was attractive to me.
It was
human.
It was very. He was very human. Yes, he was. Right. Yes, but.
So we've done our bit for the Mossa.
Yes, but I am going to say I would like to interview again at some point to talk a bit more about your work.
I'll be dead by then.
Well, I will be back, and it'll give me a good reason.
So turn off and tell me. You've been